In the run-up to the London Olympics, testers have caught more than 100 athletes using performance-enhancing drugs in recent months as part of a crackdown on doping offenders. Why, considering that they know they'd be tested, were those athletes willing to risk being banned from the games that they have trained so hard to participate in? Well, today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about doping, what it is exactly, and what is being done about it. And joining us now are Dr. Gary Wadler, an internist with special expertise in the field in drug use and sports. He served as the chairman of the World Anti-Doping Agency's Prohibited List and Methods Subcommittee, serves as ex officio member of WADA's Health, Medicine, and Research Committee. He's also the lead author of Drugs and the Athlete. And he is a clinical associate professor at the Department of Medicine in Hofstra University. Also with us is Dr. Dennis Cardone, a sports medicine specialist at NYU Langone's Center for Musculoskeletal Care and associate professor in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery. He has been a team physician for Princeton University, Rutgers University, numerous high schools, and the Paralympics. Welcome both to our show.
Thanks for being with you.
And we also welcome listeners' calls at 212-433-9692, or listeners are invited to leave a comment on our show page at wnyc.org. Let's begin with you, Dr. Cardone. We often start off these Please Explain segments with definitions. How would you define the word doping as it pertains to sports?
So when you think about doping, you need to think about what's illegal. And athletes will use some type of prohibited or illegal substance, or even a method such as self-transfusion of their own blood to gain unfairly improve their sporting performance.
And when was the term first used?
That is interesting. Doping goes way back, and they think, or where I've understood, is that it came from South Africa from a tribe using the word dope as a stimulant drink for their tribal ceremonies.
Dr. Wedler, how many banned substances are there?
Oh, there are many, and we break them down by categories in terms of those which are banned all the time, those which are banned only in competition. Depending on the kind of athletic endeavor people are considering, they may choose to do one of a variety of things, whether it's growth hormone, whether it's stimulants, whether it's anabolic steroids, and there's a whole litany of them, categorically as well individually. So you're talking very, very large numbers.
So they are involved with pain management, muscle building, increasing stamina.
Because there's a thing called therapeutic use exemption. So if an athlete, we don't want to take the honest athletes who are doing their best and abiding by the rules and then ban them because they have a substance in them that is typically banned. They have the opportunity to make a case that they have a legitimate medical condition, and therefore they would seek what they want is a therapeutic use exemption, which would allow them to take the drug, even though it was typically banned because there was a medical reason for doing it. So it's important that we just don't have a broad brush and anybody who has a substance that's on the list in their body is banned. No, that's not the case.
Dr. Wadler, there were 20 proven cases of doping in the Beijing Games 4 years ago, which included six horses. We're talking about 100 athletes this time. Were the tests more stringent this time, or have athletes not been paying attention?
I think we've gotten very good at this business of detecting the abuse of performance-enhancing drugs. And unfortunately, this is a problem that's not going to go away. I mean, it's a problem that's with us and will be with us for a long time. You know, as we... People have to remember that the things that are being abused are the things that Dr. Cardone and I use to treat patients. And we don't want people not to have the advantage of modern medicine because there's those out there who are willing to abuse and cheat. And so we will see the development of new drugs, and if they have an application in sports, you can be sure there'll be somebody out there trying to abuse them. And that's the reality. Even as we move forward into the next era of gene therapy, where there's no question we're concerned about the abuse and the development of gene doping.
Well, although that's not really been something that's been put into practice yet.
No, I'm just saying, look forward.
I can't wait.
I think the reason we're good at detecting doping is because we anticipate and we look forward.
My guests are Dr. Dennis Cardone and Dr. Gary Wadler. We're talking about doping because it's a big topic in the news right now because of the Olympics. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Dr. Cardone, why would using your own blood be considered doping?
It's all about increasing performance. So especially for an endurance athlete, most important is for them to be able to utilize oxygen as efficiently as possible. So if they, at some point prior to their competition, take out their blood, and then prior to the competition, have it re-infused, so now all of a sudden they have a higher blood count, a higher ability or an increased ability to carry oxygen, this improves their performance. So they can more efficiently use oxygen.
And so the test looks for a higher blood count? Wouldn't some people have a higher blood count naturally?
Well, that's exactly right. So, it's hard to pick up, but you're absolutely right. Some people will have a naturally higher blood count, and a good example of that is many athletes will train at a higher altitude. So that will help them to use oxygen more efficiently and will increase their blood count. So exactly, that's why some of these performance-enhancing methods that athletes use are difficult to detect. So there's a whole thing, and Dr. Wadler can really speak to this even more so. There's something now new that we call the athlete biological passport, and what that is exactly you monitor an athlete over time. You're following all of their blood parameters. So you're looking to see if there's some type of acute change in their blood levels, such as hemoglobin, hematocrit, or their oxygen-carrying capacity.
Now, what about anabolic steroids, Dr. Wadler? Aren't there two different tests done for them? What's the difference between the two tests, and are the anabolic steroids different?
Well, anabolic steroids has sort of been the bedrock, along with amphetamines, of performance-enhancing drugs. The usual way we detect it is through testing of urine. Blood testing in sport is still somewhat limited, as you probably know from the feelings of people in the National Football League and Major League Baseball. People giving up blood has run into some resistance. But the bedrock of testing for anabolic steroids is the detection in urine. Now, having said that, the two issues. One, if people take testosterone, which is really what anabolic steroids are, the synthetic derivatives of the male hormone testosterone. If they take testosterone, how do you know it's their own testosterone or it's testosterone that they self-administered? That's question one. The second, and that is somewhat more difficult, and what we call TE ratios, and as well as we are able to detect synthetic testosterone. But then there's those substances which are not in the body. Testosterone is naturally in the body, but there are anabolic steroids which are not naturally in the body, and we can detect the abuse of those substances more easily. The more difficult one is testosterone, but we've become very good at that as well, and I'll leave it there without getting too complicated for your audience.
Now, there are athletes who, again, claim that they naturally produce high levels of testosterone, that can be a problem as well, can't it? Are there certain behaviors indicative of doping? Do you ever suspect doping before any testing is done?
People looked at the change in the body composition of elite athletes and say, they're extraordinarily more muscular than they were a year or two ago. They have a lot of acne. They're irritable. There's a whole host of clues that would raise the question. Doesn't make a lead to a conclusion, but raises the question. And if the question is raised, then you have, if there's reasonable doubt, then you can certainly do testing to see whether, in fact, this was the abuse of these steroids was going on or not. And so that, but the, you can't look at somebody who is very well built, who works out in the gym, and say, "Aha, you're a drug user." May not be drug user at all. He may be somebody who just happens to be especially fit. And so, and this is a bigger issue for younger kids, adolescents, for example, who are going through adolescence, and they have acne and they have irritability and they hang out in the gym with their friends. So because they do that, you can't say, well, that equals somebody who's abusing steroids. But yes, it raises the question, might they be using that? And they should check that with their physicians.
Well, Dr. Cardone, if these athletes know they're going to be tested, everybody was warned before these Olympics, why do you think that they still use the drugs, the performance-enhancing drugs? Have they found ways of passing doping tests, or do they think they know ways of passing those doping tests?
Well, that's exactly right. You know, athletes always think that they're one step ahead of the testers. So their feeling is that, number one, there's a good possibility that even if they are tested, that they're doing something potentially, in addition, if they're taking steroids, they may also be taking what we call some type of masking agent, something else that makes it less likely that their test will become positive. So, and you know, who knows, you know, it's so competitive, obviously, the athletic environment right now, that possibly they've been doing these performance enhancers always, and this is what they need in order to be at that competitive level. So, you know, their feeling is, in order for me to get there, in order for me to be competitive, in order for me to possibly win a medal, this is what I have to do. And their hope is that they're just not going to get caught.
And they've used it in the past, and nobody's noticed, and now suddenly they're being caught. Are there any legal performance-enhancing drugs other than caffeine?
There are. There are supplements that you can get over-the-counter, and there are a few that have shown to have some performance-enhancing properties other than, yes, caffeine is one of them. But there are some others. One of the most common supplements that are used by athletes of all ages, creatine, for example, has also been shown to have some performance-enhancing properties.
So why are they allowed when the others are not?
May I sort of jump in here?
Sure, Dr.
Within the context of the World Anti-Doping Agency, for a substance to be put on the prohibited list, it has to fulfill at least 2 out of 3 criteria. It has to have the capacity to enhance performance. Its use has to represent a significant risk to one's health, and its use represents a violation of the spirit of sport. Basically, it's cheating. If you have 2 out of 3, it doesn't guarantee that that substance will be on the list, but you have to have 2 out of 3 to be considered as to whether that goes on the list. And having been chairman of that committee for a number of years, there are very, very intense discussions to decide whether a particular substance fulfills those criteria, and if they do, whether they should be on the prohibited list. It's not throwing darts. There's a real serious science behind what's on that list and what's not on that list.
Now, we assume that Babe Ruth did not use performance-enhancing drugs, Roger Maris didn't. We started hearing about these things in the 70s and 80s. Is that when they became more common? Or was it the result of the East Germans being caught using something, kind of a Cold War aspect to this whole story?
Well, this is not a new problem. History indicates that long ago athletes sought a competitive advantage by using various substances which have been dubbed, as you know, as ergogenic aids. But it goes back as far as the 3rd century B.C. when the Greeks ingested mushrooms to improve athletic performance, and gladiators used stimulants in the famed Circus Maximus to fight off fatigue and deal with injury. The 19th century saw athletes experimenting with caffeine, which you mentioned earlier, alcohol, nitroglycerin, opium, and even strychnine. And the first recorded fatality goes back into the 1800s. So this has been with us a long time. And I always like to, conversations and discussions like this, remind people of a very interesting statement by a guy named Peter Mark Latham, who said in the 1800s that poisons and medicines are the same substance given with different intents. And we have tried to measure the intent. What did the athlete have in mind when he took any one of these substances? It's very hard to measure intent. And so we don't measure intent. What we measure is the presence of the prohibited substance in the body, we use similar techniques in deciding whether somebody had the intent. So we don't. Yeah, if you use intent, you're in trouble. You have to look at the list. If it violates the spirit of sport and it's on the list, then that is what determines whether you have cheated or not.
We're talking about athletic doping on today's Please Explain with Dr. Gary Wadler, who is a clinical associate professor in the Department of Medicine at Hofstra University, and also on the he has served as the chairman of the World Anti-Doping Agency's Prohibited List and Methods Subcommittee. And Dr. Dennis Cardone, a sports medicine specialist at NYU Langone Center for Musculoskeletal Care, and he's associate professor in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery there as well. We will take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be inviting your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Back with this Please Explain look at athletic doping with Drs. Dennis Cardone and Gary Wadler. And we're inviting your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can go online at WNYC.org. Dr. Cardone, you work with both kids and adults. When typically does the pressure to consider using performance-enhancing substances begin to ramp up?
Mostly during high school. So already in high school, there's already significant competition and significant stress placed on an athlete in terms of performance. And it could be coming from coaches, it could even be coming from parents or peers. So already in high school, you know, many studies have been done that there's a significant percent of these athletes, both male and female, using some type of performance-enhancing supplements, whether they're doping, some of the illegal substances, or some of the over-the-counter supplements. So high school level would be typical.
Are most of them injected? At least that's what we heard in the baseball scandals.
It really depends what they're using. So most common, certainly, are the over-the-counter supplements, and these are taken by mouth. So in terms of testosterone, illegal doping, yes, that would be more injectable.
Let's take some calls. Ed from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. Another great topic. Thanks so much. I was wondering, we hear a lot about the athletes who are doping, the sanctions and the bans and everything that happens to them. I was curious to learn a little bit more about coaches and trainers who are found to have athletes who are doping. What happens in their cases? What kind of sanctions do they suffer? Are there bans on that front as well?
Yes, there are bans on that front, and it can cost them their careers. They pretty much are dealt the same way as an athlete who's found doping. If a trainer or other people in the entourage are found to be complicit in this, they suffer the same sanctions as a cheating athlete.
But what happens to the athlete other than a ruined reputation for a time?
Well,
can't many of them come back and compete?
For 4 years.
They're banned for 4 years.
They can, as well, some are 2 years, depending on the particular substance. But anabolic steroids, for example, it's a 4-year suspension.
Mm-hmm. Except in baseball, where you just get traded to the Yankees. Let's take another call. Alexander from Mount Kisco, how you're on the air?
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm a recreational athlete, and sometimes when I'm very tired, I take some of the over-the-counter stuff that you can find at any GNC or vitamin shop. that contain sinephrine. I think it's also called bitter orange extract, or some other mood-enhancing elements. And definitely my performances are enhanced. There is a clear difference within 30 minutes. Are those banned by the different anti-doping federations? And if yes, how come they are in to be found in retail outlets?
Well, first of all, I would suggest you look at the website of the World Anti-Doping Agency, because virtually all these questions can be answered there. And the website is www.wada-ama.org. And you will find all the substances, the categories, and so on that you're talking about. But I would caution anybody who's taking over-the-counter supplements, because there's no... In the United States, the law is such that the manufacturer does not have to guarantee safety, purity, or efficacy of the substance. So you may wind up with a sanction for something that did very little to you or for you. And we encourage athletes not to take dietary supplements unless they need to for medical reasons and have discussed that with their physicians.
Okay, thank you for calling. He mentioned that he could feel a difference. What do athletes say about how it feels when you talk to some that you have caught? Do they say that it makes them feel better, that they're aware of its effect on their performance?
Well, they make those claims, but, you know, this field is full of claims, and most of the claims have no validity. So a subjective opinion is really not what drives the engine here. It's the science and what's on the prohibited list and why it's on the prohibited list. And again, I go back to the three criteria of performance enhancement, safety, and not violating the spirit of sport. So I would be very, very careful about those things.
Well, what about...
Particularly if you're in competitive... When you have the potential to be tested in competition or related to a competition.
What about the physiological effects of performance-enhancing drugs? Aren't there side effects with some of them?
Well, certainly anabolic steroids have a whole array of side effects. The male gets feminized, the female gets masculinized. Effects on the cardiovascular system, the liver.
Are they long-term or short-term?
Very serious substances. That's one of the reasons that in the United States they are controlled substances.
Are they long-term or short-term?
Some of the effects of testosterone are reversible after stopping, but there are some non-reversible side effects related to testosterone.
A listener in the East Village asks, how do masking agents work?
Well, it works in a variety of ways. They may dilute their blood by taking an infusion of saline of fluids to dilute it. They may take a diuretic to try to hide it in the urine. Of course, we test for the diuretic. In the game of cat and mouse, in terms of masking agents, clearly the cheaters are losing that battle by a wide margin.
Let's take another call. This one is from Eric from Brooklyn. Hi, Eric. You're on the air. Eric, are you there? Okay, well, let's go instead to Bill. Bill is calling from Manhattan. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I have a question about doping on athletes and doping horses. Are the stimulants the same, or are they different, and how do they work differently?
As I mentioned earlier, there were 20 athletes caught in the Beijing Games, and six of them were horses.
Six of them were horses.
Yeah.
Were they with the same doping substance as human beings take?
Doctors?
I'm not sure. I have not particularly followed that aspect up till now. Certainly it's going to catch my attention now that this has happened. But there is an anabolic steroid, for example, that's a veterinary substance called Equipoise. Equipoise is used by doping human athletes. But I wish I can be more informative on the doping of horses, but as we speak,
I believe much of it
I'm going to pass on that.
There's been a lot in the news recently, especially with the Triple Crown and with some of the horses, and a lot of what they're using is different. It has to do with even just
simple pain relievers, even that they're using when horses are injured and having them run when injured. So there is differences absolutely in what they're
using. There is the issue, for example, of the diuretics, because some of these horses go into what we call pulmonary edema, where the fluid accumulates in the body and can be lethal, and their saliva is bloody and frothy. I don't know about the legality of that in horse racing, but clearly that's a substance that is used and has been used in horse racing.
A listener writes in, Andy from Brooklyn, can my guest weigh in on the Lance Armstrong investigation by the USADA? Apparently he's never failed a test, and yet there is a massive trial in the media being waged against him and his former colleagues.
Well, I can't really comment on that for obvious reasons, but maybe Dr. Cardone would like to opine on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we obviously none of us know enough information about it. I think certainly the concern is, you know, everybody's looking at him because he dominated the sport for so long. So people are saying, well, how could he have done that and not been using some type of supplement, whether legal or illegal? So, you know, it'll be interesting. You're absolutely right, Leonard. You know, in the news we read that he had testing done and he passed all the testing, but you know, I guess we'll have to see what comes out of the trial. As of now, like you, we don't have enough information.
We invite listener calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. You can leave a message on our show page at WNYC.org during these Please Explain segments. Eric from Brooklyn has written in. He asks, what's the difference between taking more blood through drugs and taking more oxygen through sleeping chambers, which is legal?
So if you take it through blood, there's something called EPO or erythropoietin. So it is a medication that will increase your blood level. And the feeling, one, the big thing that Dr. Wadler spoke about is certainly safety. So there's certainly significant risk potential for an athlete who's taking that medication. Their blood gets a little bit thicker, becomes a little more viscous, and they can certainly have significant heart complications. There is something in terms of training athletes, which is legal, that you talk about where it's sleep high, train low, where athletes will go to, say, Colorado or wherever it is, something at a high altitude. They'll sleep at a high altitude, and then they'll do their training at a lower altitude. And you're absolutely right, this is legal. And this does help increase their, again, what we spoke about earlier, their oxygen-carrying capacity and potentially their performance.
Irma in Brooklyn asks, which testosterone effects are reversible and which are not?
Well, the ones that are reversible tend to be the ones that affect, for example, secondary sex characteristics, but not all of them. If you develop breasts, for example, as a male, which you will, or what, you might ask, why would you develop breasts which are associated with a female if you're a male? It's simply because testosterone in the male is converted to the female hormone estrogen. And so some of those estrogen effects are reversible, but all of them are not, including development of breasts, so-called gynecomastia. But it's a sort of counterintuitive to say, why would you worry about feminization if you're taking a male hormone? And it's because it does become estrogen in the male.
Gloria from Montclair, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I want to ask a sort of tangential topic about Caster Semenya, the South African, and the idea that an issue beyond her control, which was that she had to be tested and scrutinized and disqualified for a while because they thought she was a man running as a woman. I know back in the day they actually used to test female athletes in the Olympics by looking at their genitalia, but perhaps you two can comment on this whole new can of worms of these particular athletes facing this kind of an issue.
Well, it's not totally a new can of worms. It's something that has been addressed over a period of time.
Going back to the 60s and 70s, yeah. If I remember correctly.
And one of the things, for example, if you're going to take a urine specimen for doping and you're doing your job as a monitor, you're going to watch where that urine's coming from. And so you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that if the urine's coming from someone's penis, that's evidence of being a male, conversely, if it's coming out from the urethra in a female, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure that out. And so one of the issues was put to rest by that. Now, it's much more complicated than that, but that's sort of where it's at in terms of my last...
In just the moments, the few moments we have left, you mentioned the possibility of gene doping in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's going to become a reality? How soon? And
well,
how would it be detected?
Well, the gene therapy is going to become a reality. I believe it probably will become a reality. There's things like called IGF-1, which is what human growth hormone is converted to in the body. So I think that it may not be the next Olympic Games, but it may not be in all of our lifetimes. But to me, there's no question gene therapy will become a reality, and therefore gene doping will inevitably become a reality as well.
Thank you both so much for being on Please Explain today. Dr. Gary Wadler is an internist with special expertise in the field of drug use in sports. He was the chairman of the World Anti-Doping Agency's Prohibited List and Methods Subcommittee. And Dr. Dennis Carbone is a sports medicine specialist at NYU Langone Center for Musculoskeletal Care, and he's associate professor in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery. It's been a pleasure talking with both of you.
Thank you.
Join guest host Jonathan Capehart on Monday's show when he asks TARP Administrator Neil Barofsky about the ways he thinks the $700 billion bailout fund was mishandled. And then Bravo executive Andy Cohen on his lifelong love affair with pop culture. Also, a look at the life stories of five African-American men who were recruited in 1968 to attend College of the Holy Cross, including Clarence Thomas, Edward P. Jones, and Theodore Wells. Plus, he'll also examine the nature of the American dream and whether it's still a possibility for the middle class. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Ginsey, executive producer. We had help today from Alex Geller, Judy Joe, Keith Karn, Katja Jones, and contributing producer Bonnie LaFave. Jason Isaac was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.